Paramedic here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
On July 24th, 1997, 24-year-old Amy Robechtel spent the day running errands in Lander, Wyoming, before heading out to scout a route for an upcoming 10K race she was organizing in the Wind River Mountains. But she never returned home, prompting her husband to report her missing. An extensive search of the mountains failed to uncover a single trace of her aside from her vehicle. And as the investigation unfolded, suspicion fell on Amy's husband, while other investigators later focused on a suspected serial killer. But more than 28 years later, Amy has never been found, and what happened to her remains unknown. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. Okay, so we're going to talk about Amy's case, but before we do, I just want to give an overall theme for not only this case, but just life in general. Number one priority is to solve these investigations, but short of that, we should learn from them. What do I always say? How to better protect ourselves and the people we care about. And when we get into Amy's investigation, you're going to know why I'm saying what I'm saying right now. But we've all heard that saying, if someone shows you who they are, believe them. Well, I'm going to change that up today. When society shows you what it is, believe it. We live in a crazy society. We live in a world where there are people who are out there just to hurt others. They are truly evil. And they're not just in one part of the country or one part of the world. They're everywhere. They're right in your own backyard. And you have to think like that. And the reason I say this is not to scare you, but it's to remind everyone of the unfortunate reality we all live in. We should be able to go anywhere we want, and we should be able to do it by ourselves, but that's just not where we are. We no longer live in a society where you can go out for a hike or a run on your own at night and know for a fact that you're going to be okay. You could do everything right, but if there just happens to be that one person that I'm describing who's had this itch to scratch for many years and sees you alone, they may choose you. And I'm not saying this is right, and I'm not saying that what we're going to talk about tonight in any way, shape, or form is Amy's fault. But I say this because I don't want to cover these cases anymore. And if there's one thing we know, we've been learning it since we were kids, the buddy system works. It is less likely from a statistical perspective that if you are with one or more people, someone who's looking for a victim of opportunity is less likely to choose you because not only do they have to control multiple people, but now there are multiple witnesses. So keep that in mind as we talk about cases and as you go through your daily routines and run your errands, because it's not something you should have to think about, but our society dictates that we must. And I can't promise we're going to solve Amy's case or any of the other cases I cover, but we can learn from them. But we can take these stories and apply them to our own lives to make minor adjustments to not only protect ourselves, but the people we care about. And so on that note, let's transition to Amy's case, because you've probably already started to put two and two together. To me, it appears there was a window of opportunity where someone out there, either one or more people, capitalized on a situation where Amy was alone. However, that's not what the people who actually work this case believe. They believe it involves someone much closer to home. But as always, I'm going to lay out all the facts, and I want you guys to decide what you think happened, and I'll be looking for your feedback. We have a lot to cover, so let's dive into this week's case. Amy Joy Rowe was born on August 4th, 1972 in California to her parents Dwayne, a city manager, and Joanne, a teacher. The year after Amy was born, the family moved to Jackson, Wyoming, where she grew up with her three older siblings. Amy, who was known to be determined, thoughtful, and trusting, started running in the sixth grade. She continued through high school and later attended the University of Wyoming, where she competed on the cross-country and track teams while studying exercise physiology. Amy really stood out at UW. By her junior year, she was the captain of both teams, and she had been named to the Western Athletic Conference All-Star team and held the UW record in the 3,000 meters. Amy also met her future husband while at UW, a man named Steve Bechtel. He was a few years older than her, and he was also studying exercise physiology. Like Amy, he was passionate about athletics, though his focus was rock climbing. Amy and Steve dated through college, and both went on to graduate. The couple moved in together and married in 1996. They continued pursuing their hobbies, and Steve focused on climbing and Amy on running. She ran marathons and had aspirations of qualifying for the 2000 Olympic marathon trials. In 1996, the same year they married, Steve and Amy moved to Lander, Wyoming, which was an up-and-coming rock climbing destination, but the move was not just for Steve. The area was also ideal for cross-country running, and Amy was excited about planning new routes that would challenge her. The couple moved next door to a rock climbing pioneer, Todd Skinner, and his wife, who was also named Amy. The Skinners owned Wild Iris Mountain Sports, a local outdoor equipment store where Steve and Amy both worked part-time. Amy also waited tables at the Sweetwater Grill and taught a youth weightlifting class at the Wind River Fitness Center. Steve and Amy loved Lander, and by the summer of 1997, they were ready to settle down. They started house hunting, and on July 21st, they closed on a house. By all accounts, they were both excited about the future. On the night of July 23rd, Steve and Amy went with a friend to see their new house and move a few things in. The friend later said nothing seemed to be out of the ordinary. On July 24th, Steve and Amy had big plans for the day. Steve was going with a friend to scope out a new rock climbing area while Amy planned to run some errands. Her to-do list contained 13 entries, including calling the phone company to set up their home's new phone line, getting the gas turned on, buying homeowners insurance, stopping by the camera store, and going for a run. As far as I can tell, nobody knows exactly where Amy planned to run that day. However, people knew she was organizing a 10K race that was scheduled for early September in the Loop Road area of the Wild River Mountains. Amy was still in the early planning stages and wanted to scout the area out to find the best location for the event. So she left home at approximately 9:30 a.m. and headed to the first item on her list, teaching a 90-minute children's weight training class at the fitness center. The center's owner later told the Cowboy State Daily that Amy was upbeat, though, quote, a little high-strung because she had a lot to do. After teaching the class, Amy dropped off some recycling items and contacted the phone and gas companies. Amy later stopped at the Camera Connection in downtown Lander, where she spoke with the owner about several photographs she planned to enter in the Sinks Canyon photo contest. The owner later recalled that everything seemed normal and Amy looked like she was about to go for a run. She was wearing a yellow or gold tank top, black shorts, Adidas Trail Response running shoes, a Timex Ironman triathlon watch, and a small double band wedding ring. Amy then went upstairs to Gallery 331, a portrait studio, to inquire about framing the photograph she planned to enter in the contest. Again, nothing appeared unusual. She left that location at approximately 2:30 p.m., and this was the last confirmed sighting of 24-year-old Amy. At approximately 4:30 p.m., Steve returned home and found the house empty. There was no note explaining where Amy had gone, which wasn't abnormal. You have to remember that the couple, they didn't have cell phones, so he had no way to check in with her, and he wasn't immediately alarmed because he had returned earlier than expected due to the afternoon rain, and he knew Amy still had a lot to accomplish that day. But as the hours passed, darkness fell, and Amy had still not returned. And Steve began to worry. So at approximately 10 p.m., he called Amy's parents to see if she had made a trip to visit them, and they told him that they had not heard from her. So Steve then contacted the Fremont County Sheriff's Office and reported Amy missing. And unlike a lot of the cases we cover, investigators did take the report seriously, and they were concerned that she may have been injured while running and stranded in the elements. So they began organizing a search and rescue team to deploy at daybreak. Steve also informed the Skinners about what was going on, so they got into their vehicle and headed out to search the area where Amy had been planning the upcoming 10K, while Steve remained at home in case she called or returned. The Skinners made their way out to the Loop Road area, which, according to Outside Magazine, begins as a paved highway on the outskirts of Lander. It follows the Poposia River through Sinks Canyon State Park before turning into gravel switchbacks that climb approximately 1,500 feet over 6 miles to Fry Lake. The switchbacks leading to Fry Lake is the area people believe Amy was considering for the 10K event. Now, one other thing I want to mention quickly, and I'm sure the locals will correct me, please do, I'm looking for it on this one, because our team was going back and forth on this. Loop Road is what we're seeing in a lot of the research, a lot of the documents, but I've also seen that it's referred to as Lewis Lake Road as well. So if you're looking on maps and you're trying to follow along, you can look up either of those roads. But please, for the people who are from the Wyoming area, specifically Lander, let me know what's the correct way, and people can follow you in the comments on that one. During the day, the traffic on Loop Road is sporadic but not uncommon. At night, however, the area is largely deserted. The road passes campgrounds, firewood gathering areas, and hiking trailheads. Approximately halfway along the road, about 35 minutes from Lander, is an area known as Burnt Gulch. It was there, on a turnoff road, that the Skinners discovered Amy's empty white Toyota Tercel wagon. The vehicle was unlocked, which was not unusual for Amy or others in the area. Inside, they found her keys, a pair of $120 sunglasses, and her to-do list. At the bottom of the list were notes referencing landmarks and odometer readings, so it appeared that Amy had been documenting the first section of the proposed 10K race route as she drove along Loop Road. Nothing about the car or the note immediately stood out. The only thing that appeared to be missing was Amy's green Eagle Creek wallet, which she never carried with her while she was running. The Skinners called Steve at home and told him that they had found Amy's car. So one of the Skinners drove the vehicle back to town, while Steve and her friend went to the area with lanterns, a sleeping bag, and a first aid kit to search for Amy. When daylight arrived, hundreds of people began searching a 5-mile radius around where Amy's car was found, but there was no sign of her anywhere. So searchers eventually expanded the search area to approximately 20 miles, but again, still nothing was found. But investigators were confident that Amy had been in the area on July 24th. As I just mentioned, her to-do list showed signs that she had been driving along Loop Road. In addition to that, investigators heard from two witnesses, along with a couple, who both reported seeing Amy jogging in the area at approximately 5 p.m. The witnesses said that Amy stood out because this was not an area known for jogging. It was more common to see people hiking. But despite these sightings, there was never a single piece of evidence placing Amy in the area other than her vehicle. And that really surprised the searchers. They were experienced volunteers who participated in approximately 50 large-scale searches every year. These weren't your typical volunteers who just wanted to help. These were trained rescue hikers and rock climbers, and they included specialists in steep-angle searches, swift water searches, and cave rescues. They also had trackers, air spotters, and cadaver dogs, so they really had their stuff together, and yet they were unsuccessful in finding any trace of Amy. And because they were trained and experienced and had the proper equipment, they firmly believed that if Amy was out there, whether she had been injured or attacked by wildlife, they would have found her, or at the very least, found some trace of her. But over the course of an 8-day search, they found nothing. Not even a scrap of clothing. Because of that, investigators began turning their attention toward the possibility of foul play, so FBI agents joined the investigation alongside the sheriff's office. But there were immediate challenges. The Gulch area had never been secured or treated as a crime scene, and for more than 1 week, hundreds of people had been searching around the area, destroying any potential evidence. The same was true for Amy's vehicle, which, as I told you guys earlier, had been driven home by the Skinners. They were trying to do the right thing. They didn't know it was going to turn into this, but we have to call it out for what it is. I'm going to talk about what could have potentially been done if it had been secured at the crime scene and what evidence the area could have held if nobody had entered it without law enforcement. But at this point, yeah, we're going to talk about it, but it doesn't really make a difference. It's just a missed opportunity. But I don't blame the searchers and I don't blame the Skinners. At this point, the number one priority was to find Amy, and that's exactly what they were attempting to do. So it's an unfortunate situation, but I understand it, and it happens more than you think. Steve told investigators that he spent the afternoon with a friend approximately 75 miles from Lander in Du Bois scouting rock climbing locations. And the investigators spoke with the friend, who corroborated Steve's account, but even after that, they did not appear to believe Steve. They tried to find an impartial third party who could place the two men in Du Bois that day, but as far as I can tell, they were unable to do so. So investigators obtained a search warrant for the Brechtel home and Steve's truck. They used luminol and cadaver dogs, but found no physical evidence. However, investigators have said they contained, quote, dark poetry concerning power, death, and killing. They believed the writings could indicate Steve was responsible for Amy's disappearance. Investigators continued questioning Steve, and he maintained that he had been with a friend on July 24th. He also explained that these journal entries they were concerned about, they were actually song lyrics that he had written when he was in a punk band during high school, years before he had ever even met Amy. But even after all of that, detectives did not appear to be convinced, and when they spoke with Amy's brother Nell, their suspicions increased. You see, Nell told investigators about a dinner where Amy and Steve were visiting, and during that evening, he noticed a bruise on Amy, and if you're to believe some of the reports, nothing substantiated, the bruise was on her arm. Again, not confirmed. But according to Nell, Amy joked and said that Steve could get a little rough at times, and Nell found her reaction unusual. He said she laughed it off, but she would not look him in the eye, and in his opinion, that was not a normal response, especially for Amy. As far as I can tell, Nell was the only person who expressed concerns about the relationship. Everyone else described the Brechtels as having a loving marriage. And listen, two things can be true, right? On one hand, they could have appeared to be a loving couple to everyone they met, and that may have been organic or it may have been manufactured. On the other hand, Nell, this interpretation of what happened that night, it could have been a miscommunication, right? There could have been a bruise, and maybe Amy was actually joking and Nell just took it the wrong way. On the other hand, although it's minor, was it a little bit of a look into something much deeper? You could sit here all day and dissect it. The reality is we weren't there. We don't know what was said, how it was said, but I'm bringing it up here because we're talking about a missing woman, and one of the people being considered as a suspect is her husband. So having this information is relevant. Does it mean that he's a murderer? No. Does it mean that he even caused the bruise? Absolutely not. It's just information that we all need to be aware of. And so after speaking with Nell and learning this new information, on August 5th, Steve participated in his fourth interview with detectives. And during that interview, an FBI agent claimed that they had evidence that he had actually killed Amy, and they asked him to take a polygraph examination. And it was at that point that Steve realized he was a suspect and decided to hire an attorney. And after speaking with his attorney, they advised him not to take the polygraph, later saying that that was advice he gave every client. But as you can imagine, Steve's refusal to take the polygraph caused detectives to focus even more heavily on the theory that he was responsible. They publicly accused him of knowing more than he was saying. The sheriff even told Unsolved Mysteries, quote, statistically, he did it. That's a stretch. To come out publicly and say that, I don't agree with it, right? You need more than just a hunch. However, I don't have access to the files. And it does make me wonder, as a former investigator, what do they know that I don't? There's multiple FBI agents, there's sheriff's office, there's the detectives. And they're all thinking that this guy's good for it. So even though it appears that Steve has somewhat of an alibi, it's very evident that investigators aren't buying it. Or at minimum, they believe he could have went out, scouted the rock climbing area, and still got back in time to be involved with whatever happened to Amy. But the mistake here is focusing too much on one person and developing tunnel vision and trying to force the pieces to fit. Yes, Steve's on the table. We all acknowledge that. However, there are still other scenarios at play, and we're going to talk about one of them right after the break, and I'll tell you this, it involves a potential serial killer. We'll be right back. Between diets, workouts, and endless advice, it's hard to know what actually works for weight loss and what's worth your time. That's why Hers offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications that now include the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, you can lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when you combine diet and exercise. It helps regulate your appetite, helps you eat less, and most importantly, it helps you keep the weight off. And the process is simple. Everything happens 100% online. You connect with a licensed provider who determines if treatment is right for you, and if prescribed, medication gets delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. Plus, you get access to ongoing support, care team messaging, and lifestyle tools designed to help build habits that actually last. So if you're ready to reach your goals, visit forhers.com/detective to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/detective. One more time, forhers.com/detective. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com. All right, we're back, but we're not done with Steve yet. Investigators continued looking into him even when some evidence appeared to support his account. For example, a witness claimed to have seen Steve approximately 45 minutes from home on Loop Road at approximately 5 p.m., a sighting investigators considered part of the evidence that Steve was involved. However, phone records showed that Steve had made a call from his house at 4:43 p.m., meaning he could not have been on Loop Road at 5 p.m. And so investigators continued trying to speak with Steve, but on the advice of his attorney, he declined further interviews, which only frustrated detectives even more, which I'm sure is not a surprise to any of you. Amy's family also appeared to be frustrated as well. On multiple occasions, they publicly stated they wanted Steve to take the polygraph. They questioned why he would refuse if he was innocent. And listen, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on polygraphs. We already know the flaws with them. They're not a science. They're not even admissible in certain courts. And I will say that Steve didn't run from this. He explained his decision publicly to the media, saying that polygraphs aren't reliable. And there was already evidence showing that he had an alibi. So as far as he was concerned, he had already made his case. It could only hurt him by taking the polygraph. And if he's innocent, I agree with him. And so the investigation continued. And during that time, there were some changes inside the sheriff's office. Approximately 2 months into the investigation, the lead investigator turned the case over to another investigator and shifted his focus on a campaign to run for sheriff. He was later elected, but his time in office was short. You see, less than 2 years later, he resigned amid allegations of impropriety and was eventually convicted of stealing cocaine from an evidence locker. Obviously, this is important. This is the same guy who was originally going after Steve and had this tunnel vision. So at minimum, we know his moral fiber is not there and the ethics are questionable. So at this point, you have to question every case he's ever worked. And that's concerning, not only for Amy's family, but also for Steve and everybody else involved, because now you know you had a guy at the helm who probably shouldn't have been there. But on a positive note, the second investigator, he worked with the FBI agents to obtain NASA satellite images of the area where Amy disappeared. But as far as I can tell, the images provided didn't give any useful information. So months later, the FBI even reached out to Russia after learning its space station had also captured satellite images of Wyoming around that same time. Again, From what I've learned, there was extensive cloud cover during that time, and so those images were unusable as well. But A for effort, they were trying different innovative practices, and that's all I ask for with these investigations. Think outside the box. Maybe you get lucky. And so the investigation continued, and in 2003, hikers found a watch in the Middle Fork of the Popoja River. This watch matched the description of the watch that Amy was wearing when she went jogging on the day she disappeared. Now, this was the first possible sign of Amy since they found her vehicle. But unfortunately, investigators were unable to determine whether the watch actually belonged to her. And I won't lie to you guys, I'm a little stumped by this one. I've never seen the watch. I don't think anybody in the public has. I'd have to see the condition of it, but I would imagine that there would be some remnants of the watch. And if it did in fact belong to Amy, Steve would have been able to identify it. However, there's a little bit of a hurdle there, right? They also think he could be the suspect. So I do wonder, was Steve ever shown the watch? Did they show family members or did they just use reference photos? I don't know. I would think as long as the watch is in a pile of dust, they would be able to determine whether or not it was the same brand or make or color of Amy's watch. And yet, from what I can tell, they were never able to come to a definitive conclusion, which, like I said, I'm confused by. If they want to reach out to me, I'd be more than willing to pass that information along to you guys later. The door is open. By the following year, Amy had been missing for 7 years. Steve petitioned to have her declared dead in absentia, which essentially means declaring a missing person dead even when her remains have not been found. He later remarried and had children. He continued speaking with the media, bringing awareness to Amy's disappearance and maintaining his innocence. Investigators, on the other hand, continued publicly stating that they believe Steve was responsible. In fact, in July of 2007, on the 10-year mark of Amy's disappearance, the second lead investigator told the Billings Gazette, quote, "In my mind, there is only one person that I want to talk to. Only one person who has refused to talk to law enforcement, and that's her husband." Listen, he didn't outright say that he's the guy, but yeah, we're all reading between the lines, and most of the public is going to come to a similar conclusion that law enforcement has done all the work, they've vetted all the other possibilities, and 10 years later, they're still looking at one guy, so it's got to be him, right? If I'm looking at this, maybe it's just the opportunity for the second investigator to sit down and really vet the alibi from that investigator's perspective, now knowing that the first investigator didn't do the best job. But yeah, optics are everything, and this is going to be interpreted as there's only one person who hasn't cooperated, and therefore they must be hiding something. So not the right approach, in my opinion, but I would imagine his thought process was maybe if I call him out publicly, it'll force him to come forward and speak to me, which doesn't normally work that way. In 2010, things finally took a turn when a new investigator, Sergeant John Zerga, was assigned to Amy's case. He reviewed the file, and one tip immediately stood out to him. The tip came from a man named Richard Eaton. He is the brother of Dale Eaton, a convicted murderer and suspected serial killer. In 2004, Dale was convicted of the 1988 rape and murder of Lisa Marie Kimmel, who disappeared while driving from Denver, Colorado to Billings, Montana. Her body was found in Wyoming, though her car wasn't located. She had been raped, bludgeoned, and stabbed to death. Lisa's case went cold and her vehicle remained missing until after Dale's arrest in 2002, when detectives found it buried on his property in Fremont County, Wyoming. Investigators also found women's clothing, purses, and numerous newspaper articles about other missing and murdered women, which led some authorities to theorize that Dale was the Great Basin serial killer who is suspected of killing at least 9 women across Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and Nevada between 1983 and 1997. Unfortunately, and I'm sure it's no surprise to anyone, Dale has refused to speak to detectives and has only been convicted in Lisa's murder, so it's unclear if he's responsible for any of the unsolved murders, but this is a bad guy. He was involved in killing one of his cellmates and for kidnapping a couple with a baby. So he's definitely a bad guy and someone we should be looking at, not only for Amy's case, but all of these other cases in that area. And I also want to point out, because I think it's worth mentioning, that from what I've read, and I don't know how true it is, after Dale was tied to Amy's disappearance, apparently Stephen came forward and said, hey, can I look at some of the items that were found on his property? Maybe I'll be able to identify some of them as belonging to Amy. But apparently he was denied by law enforcement. So that's not a surprise to me. I don't know how much of that story is true. If it is, it's unfortunate because I do think that would be a good tactic to deploy. But on the other hand, when you consider the people working the case and the fact that they think Steve's involved, they're going to assume that, yeah, sure, he's going to identify something as belonging to Amy because he wants to put the heat on Dale when really he's the guy responsible. And so you see the thought process there. Even if he positively identified something as belonging to Amy's, law enforcement wasn't going to believe him. Now, on the other hand, just to play devil's advocate, if Stephen is responsible for what happened, that would be exactly what he would want to do, right? Oh, here's my opportunity to put it on someone else. I got to get involved. Hey, I'm willing to cooperate with you guys now. Let me look at what you found. Oh, look at that. That belongs to Amy. See, wasn't me, guys. So I see both sides to it. It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate we got to this point because the real person who suffers here is Amy. But let's go back to Richard, Dale's brother, because that's how we got here, right? According to him, Dale had been camping in the Burnt Gulch area when Amy's vehicle was found. Richard said that he and Dale frequently hunted and fished in that exact area, and Richard was able to accurately describe specific geographical features of that location, so it sounds like he was telling the truth. But despite that, the original investigators, they dismissed the tip, believing it was false information and that Richard was motivated by the reward being offered in Amy's case. That may be true, but you still have an obligation to vet that lead. You're not the judge and jury right there. If someone comes forward, you follow the breadcrumbs until they're no longer viable. And they didn't do that. They just assumed that because of who it was, because of the source of information, they were motivated by money. And if I had to bet, they probably never followed up on it at all. But after Sergeant Zerga was assigned to the case in 2010 and he learned about this tip, he traveled to the prison and he tried to speak with Dale. But like he had done before, Dale refused to cooperate. A few years later, in 2012, a woman who owned property in Waltman, Wyoming, where Dale had been living when Amy disappeared, went through some of his belongings. Investigators had searched through them before, but they had missed some newspapers and a receipt. And when the woman looked closer at these items, she noticed they corresponded with the time frame and area of Amy's disappearance. So she turned those items over to the FBI, and according to Zerga, the FBI ultimately ruled that Eaton wasn't involved. However, Zerga has publicly said he disagrees with that assessment. He believes it's possible that Dale was involved in Amy's disappearance, and I agree with him. And I'm going to continue to agree with him until the FBI comes out publicly and states, yes, we do not believe Eaton was involved, and here are the reasons why. It's not just an opinion. We have exculpatory evidence to support it. At that point, I will publicly state that I've changed my mind. But until then, I don't know how you can rule somebody out when you haven't even had the opportunity to speak with them. How do you know where they were on that particular day? How do you know for certain that Dale did not cross paths with Amy? My guess, they don't. The next big update in Amy's case wasn't until 2025. That year, Sergeant Zerga told the Cowboy State Daily that he considers Dale Eaton a prime suspect in Amy's disappearance. He said he continues trying to get Dale to speak with him, but so far, he has been unsuccessful. In that same interview, Zerga also revealed that he has not officially ruled Steve out as a suspect either. According to Zerga, the only way to do that would be through a polygraph. And I like what Zerga's doing here. I like that he's trying new approaches, but I don't agree with this. And maybe Zerga doesn't believe it either. Maybe he's just trying to get Steve to come in and talk to him. But we all know that a polygraph is there to support whatever law enforcement believes. But if it doesn't, it's just going to go by the wayside. So I don't think if Steve took the polygraph and passed it, it's going to change everyone's opinion. And they're going to say, oh yeah, he definitely didn't do it. Look at that. He passed the polygraph. He's cleared. If they haven't come to that conclusion already, a polygraph isn't going to do it. Sergeant Zerga also provided a general update on the investigation. He said Fremont County has two investigators who continue to follow up on leads whenever they come in. They have not given up on finding out what happened to Amy. Unfortunately, that is the last update we have in Amy's case. More than 28 years later, she is still missing, leaving investigators, her loved ones, and an entire community wondering what happened to Amy Roe Bechtel. All right, so let's dive into the perspective. The first thing I have to start with, which I don't believe is a possibility, but can I say it's a 0% possibility? No, I can't. And for that reason, I'm going to mention it just to make sure we cover all of our bases. And that would be the scenario that Amy goes out there, she's jogging, she's scouting different locations, and for some reason she decides to go off the path. I don't know what would cause her to do that. Or she goes into an area where she's attacked by an animal. And even though 99% of the time, these searchers would be able to find her or some trace of her, this is an anomaly. This is a one in a million thing that happens. And for some reason, there is no trace, or at least they are unable to find it due to environmental circumstances. So I say this could be a tragic accident slash animal attack, just to make sure that we're covering all of our bases. But I don't think that's what happened here. And we need to focus on the players in this game, because I truly believe that whatever happened to Amy, it was the result of foul play. I do want to elaborate a little on the two suspects we've already talked about. I also want to talk about the shoulda, coulda, woulda, even though it's not going to do much now, but it's important to discuss the investigative tactics that could have been implemented to maybe have this be a different result than where we are right now. Let's start with Steve right off the bat. Let's dive into him, because I know that I kind of framed it tonight as if, you know, Steve's been cooperative and they're just trying to pin this whole thing on him, even though he appears to be innocent. And that could be the case. I've said it in the episode. I don't have all the facts. I don't have the case files. I will acknowledge that with all of these investigators, including Sergeant Zurgas, not being able to clear him, there's a hole there. His alibi cannot be as secure as he wants us to believe. And I did mention at the top of the show that although he was out at this rock climbing location scouting it, and it was approximately 75 miles away, he did come back early. There was rain. And I know that I have these weird interpretations sometimes, and I can be off, and you guys will call me out. I got all my part-time detectives in the comment section. So I'm going to pose a question to you guys, and you tell me if I'm crazy here. But here's the scenario. You come home after a day out, and let's just say you were out rock climbing, okay? You come home early and your partner's not there, all right? And you're not alarmed immediately, but you knew what her plans were for the day. And you knew that at one point she was going to go out for a run and potentially scout an area. And although you didn't know the exact location, you had a general vicinity, because as I mentioned in the episode, as soon as Steve told the Skinners, they went out to the location that they believed she was scouting for the 10K, and pretty quickly they were able to find her vehicle. So my first question is, Steve, why didn't you go out there? You must have known as well. Before doing anything else, before calling the police and calling the family and calling the Skinners or going over to the Skinners' house, why wouldn't you drive out to the location? Why wouldn't you go see if your wife is out there and maybe she's injured? You're going to get there faster than anybody else. You're the first one to realize that she's missing. For me personally, I'd be going out there. Maybe I'd make a couple quick calls, but I'm not waiting for someone to come and recommend that we go out there. I'm going. By myself, with a friend, it doesn't matter. I'm going out there. Now, the second wrinkle to this is, let's say you don't go out there, but then you tell the Skinners about what's going on and they say, well, we're going to go out there. You know what I'm going to say? Hey, I got a better idea. I'm going to go out there. It's my wife. I want to search the area myself. Would one of you mind staying here and manning the phone? And if by chance Amy comes home, notifying someone to let us know that she's been found, whatever that is. I don't know if nobody has a cell phone at this point. I know Steve didn't have one, but by some way of communication, or drive out to us, let us know that she's been found and she's home. But I, as the husband, I'm not staying home and sitting by the phone or hoping that my wife comes home. I'm going out to search for her. If you have another body who's capable of staying there, That's who I'm letting stay there. Am I crazy? Please let me know. Because to me, I don't think this is a smoking gun. But if you're looking at Steve like these investigators are, I have a suspicion that some of this behavior was also the reason that they were not completely on board with Steven being innocent here. Because if you're to approach this from the perspective that Steven did do it, then here's the play out, right? He comes home early and maybe Amy is there. And for some reason, beyond what we know, something goes down. There is an altercation and there's a fight and something bad happens to Amy. I don't know how we got there. I don't know the motive. We're not even going to approach that yet. But something happens, and so Steven drives her out to this location, leaves her there somewhere in a different area, parks the car, and somehow gets back. I don't know how he gets back. I don't know if he had a co-conspirator. Just ride along with me here. But he goes back to the house. He waits a couple hours. Then he calls the police, and then he involves the Skinners. He knows that they know where she's going to be at or where she might be. So he involves them. He lets them know what's going on. And then they suggest, hey, we're going to go out and look for her. And he goes, you know what? That's a great idea. I'll stay here and monitor the phone, knowing that they're going to find her car. And then they're the people who found it, not him. Again, it's a leap. This is a large leap. But I think this, coupled with the fact that there is a window where they believe physically Steve could have got back in time, did some of the things that I just mentioned, or maybe even went out to this location with Amy and still got back in time and still cleaned up and still made it look like he had nothing to do with it. My thoughts on Steve, I don't know. I'm not going to say he's innocent. I'm not going to say he's guilty. From what we've learned, there's definitely not enough here to say he's the prime suspect. I think the prime suspect is Dale Eaton or someone like Dale Eaton. And that's what I want to focus on now. So first off, Dale, he looks good for this. You have the brother of a man who has a horrific criminal history and is currently in prison for the brutal murder of a woman and maybe tied to additional murders, who is now being placed at the potential scene of the crime, right? We know where Amy's vehicle was found, and the brother is saying, that's where we go. That's where we go to hunt and fish. And I know that my brother was out there during that time. Pretty strong lead. You have someone who's a violent criminal who's out there potentially alone while your victim is out there alone. They had to have some form of transportation. Dale would have had a vehicle to get out there, so he could have attacked her, thrown her into his vehicle, and you would have never seen her again. So Dale's someone that needs to be vetted. And I do understand that at this point, you would probably need a confession. But I do want to mention, and this is the part that's troubling, if the area had been contained, if the Skinners had not driven the vehicle home, if they had just called the police, you could have taped off that area and you would have looked at it. I don't know what the topography is right there, but if there's dirt or gravel, you could have looked for tire impressions, foot impressions. You could have also processed the vehicle for DNA. And if by chance you found tire track marks that matched Dale Eaton's vehicle, or you found footprint impressions that matched one of Dale Eaton's boots, or if best case scenario, you found Dale Eaton's DNA inside or outside Amy's vehicle, that's a home run. And if it's not Dale, maybe it's another guy, someone like Dale who we haven't identified yet, and you find his tire impressions or his boot impressions or his DNA. But again, unfortunately, I've said it a couple times, you can't do that now, but it is something worth mentioning, because if you or somebody you know or another case we cover comes up, this is something you need to consider. You want to help, but you also want to make sure that you're not tampering with any potential evidence that could help solve the case. If you ever find yourself in a similar situation and there's not someone there who's in need of immediate medical attention, take a step back. Observe. If you don't need to intervene at that moment, call law enforcement. Let them make the determination. Again, not blaming the Skinners. Most people would have done the same. But in hindsight, I think these stories, there's something we can always learn from them. And in this story, that is definitely one of the things that I'm taking away. And so that's really where I fall on this one. I think it's either Steven, Dale Eaton, or another hiker or camper or hunter or fisher who was out in that area and happened to see Amy, and either they pulled over to the side of the road and pretended like their car was broke down Amy stopped, and when she got out of her vehicle, they got the jump on her. Or on the other hand, she was pulled over, they were driving by, they pulled over, and then they attacked her. Either one is plausible, and that could be anybody from that area. It could even be someone who was just passing through, although that is much less likely. So a lot of potential suspects here, and at this point, I really think we're in a position where we need someone to talk. We need someone to come forward. And before I get into that, these are the two things that I would say to the immediate people that we've talked about the most in this episode. Steve, if you're innocent, you've had a rough go of it, and you're also a victim here if you had nothing to do with it. You know, I would tell you, if you're guilty, you don't want to take the polygraph, right? If you're innocent, and this is coming from a guy who's former law enforcement, you don't want to take the polygraph. It's not going to help you either way. You know, I know, we know, they've already made up their minds about you. And unless they find another person responsible, they're always going to think that you had something to do with it. So unfortunately, all you can do right now, if you're innocent, is continue to fight for Amy and promote her story and make sure that everyone knows about it while also living your own life, because you're entitled to do that. You should do that. You're a victim here as well. On the other hand, if you're responsible, you got away with it so far. It's been 28 years. But understand, there have been cases older than this that have been solved. So if you had something to do with it, you got to look over your shoulder every day. And it could be tomorrow that they come knocking on your door. Just keep that in mind. As far as Dale's concerned, I'm not going to talk to him directly. I haven't even looked to see if he's still alive. He's not going to talk. He's a scumbag. He's a murderer. He's a monster. Gets gratification out of this. And these monsters, as demonic as they are, in their minds, they're always a victim, right? He didn't do this. The cops are just blaming him. They framed him. He's a good guy, just in the wrong place at the wrong time, right? That's the story you hear a lot in prison. He's never going to admit to anything else, because in his mind, he's thinking, you know what? If I somehow get off on Lisa's murder, I get to go free, right? But if I admit to all these other murders, then I'm here for the rest of my life. So spoiler alert, he is there for the rest of his life. But in his mind, he's holding on to that kernel of hope that he might get out. Not going to happen. Sorry to tell you, buddy. So back to where we leave this episode. We need someone to come forward. You have to hope that there are either multiple people involved, or the person responsible confided in someone or came home that day and displayed some odd behavior that was noted by their partners or their family members or friend. And for some reason, after all these years, they have not come forward. And maybe now's the time, after hearing this case and hear about the story itself, and maybe knowing that there are other people being accused of this crime who didn't do it, you have the opportunity to come forward and give Amy's family the answers that they've been searching for almost 30 years. In addition to that, if Steven's not responsible, you have the ability to exonerate him, something that he's been accused of for the same amount of time. The people working this case believe that he's somehow involved. You can clear him once and for all. So, just to recap, 24-year-old Amy Rowe Bechtel was last seen at approximately 2:30 p.m. on July 24th, 1997 in downtown Lander, Wyoming. Investigators believe that Amy later drove to the Loop Road area in the Wind River Mountains, where her vehicle was later found that night near Burnt Gulch. Multiple witnesses reported seeing a woman matching Amy's description jogging in the area at approximately 5 p.m., but no trace of Amy has ever been found. If you have any information in Amy's case, please call the Fremont County Sheriff's Office at 307-332-5611. My final words, as always, go out to the friends and family of Amy. I know 28 years is a long time, and for you, this is a nightmare that you've never woke up from. And although you have moved on and continued to live your lives, I'm sure the pain that you feel today is the same pain you felt when you first learned of Amy's disappearance. You need justice. You need relief. You need to know once and for all what happened to her. And I'm hoping that a community member finally comes forward and gives us that one piece of information that we need to get the ball rolling again and figure out once and for all what happened to Amy. I hope I get the opportunity to sit right here and let all of you know what happened to Amy as well. But until then, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.
guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.